So good afternoon and welcome to another episode, something in the 30s of Read Me Something You Love. And today I have sitting with me in the London Met recording studio, which I have created here by positioning two chairs upended on tables. I don't hope it'll work. In the London Met recording studio with Mr. Kevin Porter. Throw in the mister there.
That's very kind, Steve.
Kevin Porter, who has come all the way down from Wolverhampton,
yes,
to record a little bit of Kafka for Read Me Something You Love. I feel really, really chuffed and grateful to you for coming down all the way from Wolverhampton. I mean, how far away is Wolverhampton? I've never been. It feels like it's a million miles
away.
It's
not a place you would go to, I don't think, really. It takes 2 hours, 2.25 hours to come down by car.
I'm really looking forward to this. It's such a fantastic story. And I think I believe you've got the perfect voice for reading Kafka.
It's very kind of you to say so. I'm sure that can't be true, but we'll give it a go.
But I think for a specific reason as well, because Kafka, I would imagine, spoke German with a Czech accent.
Yes.
So he wasn't speaking kind of RP German.
No, no.
And when I remember when I emailed you and I said, you know, that would be great if you can read the Kafka. And you said, oh, well, you know, it's going to be quite strange sort of hearing it in my
black country accent. Yes, indeed.
And I actually thought about that. And I thought, you know what? I actually think that that's perfect. I almost think that that's, you know, if Kafka were here and he had to choose between you and Derek Jacobi. Although, where's Derek Jacobi from? He's probably from that part of the world as well.
Do you know? I don't know whether he is. He might well be. I think he probably comes in at, I think I undercut him in terms of how much it would cost Kafka to actually employ somebody to read his story. So,
but I think if he had to choose, I think he would choose you.
All right. Okay.
And on that note, let's begin.
A Hunger Artist by Franz Kafka. During these last decades, the interest in professional fasting has markedly diminished. It used to pay very well to stage such great performances under one's own management. But today, that is quite impossible. We live in a different world now. At one time, the whole town took a lively interest in the hunger artist. From day to day of his fast, the excitement mounted. Everybody wanted to see him at least once a day. There were people who bought season tickets for the last few days and sat from morning till night in front of his small barred cage. Even in the night time, there were visiting hours when the whole effect was heightened by torch flares. On fine days, the cage was set out in the open air. And then, it was the children's special treat to see the hunger artist. For their elders, he was often just a joke that happened to be in fashion. But the children stood open-mouthed, holding each other's hands for greater security, marvelling at him as he sat there, pallid in black tights, with his ribs sticking out so prominently. Not even on a seat, but down among the straw in the ground. Sometimes giving a courteous nod, answering questions with a constrained smile, or perhaps stretching out an arm through the bars so that one might feel how thin it was. And then again, withdrawing deep into himself, paying no attention to anyone or anything, not even to the all-important striking of the clock that was the only piece of furniture in his cage, but merely staring into vacancy with half-shut eyes, now and then taking a sip from a tiny glass of water to moisten his lips. Besides casual onlookers, there were also relays of permanent watchers selected by the public, usually butchers, strangely enough, and it was their task to watch the hunger artist day and night, three of them at a time, in case he should have some secret recourse to nourishment. This was nothing but a formality, instigated to reassure the masses, for the initiates knew well enough that during his fast, the artist would never, in any circumstances, not even under forcible compulsion, swallow the smallest morsel of food. The honour of his profession forbade it. Not every watcher, of course, was capable of understanding this. There were often groups of night watchers who were very lax in carrying out their duties, and deliberately huddled together in a retired corner to play cards with great absorption, obviously intending to give the hunger artist the chance of a little refreshment, which they supposed he would draw from some private hoard. Nothing annoyed the artist more than these watchers. They made him miserable. They made his fast seem endurable. Sometimes he mastered his feebleness sufficiently to sing during their watch for as long as he could keep going, to show them how unjust their suspicions were. But that was of little use. They only wondered at his cleverness in being able to fill his mouth even while singing. Much more to his taste were the watchers who sat up close to the bars, who were not content with the dim night lighting of the hall, but focused him in the full glare of the electric pocket torch given them by the impresario. The harsh light did not trouble him at all. In any case, he could never sleep properly, and he could always drowse a little, whatever the light, at any hour, even when the hall was thronged with noisy onlookers. He was quite happy at the prospect of spending a sleepless night with such watchers. He was ready to exchange jokes with them, to tell them stories of his nomadic life, anything at all to keep them awake, and demonstrate to them again that he had no eatables in his cage, and that he was fasting as not one of them could fast. But his happiest moment was when the morning came, and an enormous breakfast was brought for them at his expense, on which they flung themselves with the keen appetite of healthy men after a weary night of wakefulness. Of course, there were people who argued that this breakfast was an unfair attempt to bribe the watchers, but that was going rather too far. And when they were invited to take on a night's vigil without a breakfast, merely for the sake of the cause, they made themselves scarce, although they stuck stubbornly to their suspicions. Such suspicions, anyhow, were a necessary accompaniment to the process of fasting. No one could possibly watch the hunger artist continuously, day and night, and so no one could produce first-hand evidence that the fast had really been rigorous and continuous. Only the artist himself could know that. He was therefore bound to be the sole completely satisfied spectator of his own fast. Yet, for other reasons, he was never satisfied. It was not perhaps mere fasting that had brought him to such skeleton thinness that many people had regretfully to keep away from his exhibitions because the sight of him was too much for them. Perhaps it was dissatisfaction with himself that had worn him down. For he alone knew, what no other initiate knew, how easy it was to fast. It was the easiest thing in the world. He made no secret of this, yet people did not believe him. At best, they set him down as modest. Most of them, however, thought he was out for publicity, or else he was some kind of cheat, who found it easy to fast because he had discovered a way of making it easy. and then had the impudence to admit the fact, more or less. He had to put up with all that, and in the course of time had got used to it. But his inner dissatisfaction always rankled. And never yet, after any term of fasting, and this must be granted to his credit, had he left the cage of his own free will. The longest period of fasting was fixed by his impresario at 40 days. Beyond that term, he was not allowed to go, not even in great cities, and there was a good reason for it too. Experience had proven that for about 40 days, the interest of the public could be stimulated by a steadily increasing pressure of advertisement. But after that, the town began to lose interest. Sympathetic support began notably to fall off. There were, of course, local variations as between one town or another, or one country and another. But as a general rule, 40 days marked the limit. So, on the 40th day, the flower-bedecked cage was opened. Enthusiastic spectators filled the hall. A military band played. Two doctors entered the cage to measure the results of the fast, which were announced through a megaphone. And finally, two young ladies appeared, blissful at having been selected for the honour, to help the hunger artist down the few steps leading to a small table on which was spread a carefully chosen invalid repast. At this very moment, the artist always turned stubborn. True, he would entrust his bony arms to the outstretched helping hands of the ladies bending over him, but stand up, he would not. Why stop fasting at this particular moment, after 40 days of it? He had held out for a long time, an illimitably long time. Why stop now, when he was in his best fasting form, or rather, not yet quite in his best fasting form? Why should he be cheated of the fame he would get for fasting longer, for being not only the record hunger artist of all time, which presumably he was already, but for beating his own record by a performance beyond human imagination, since he felt that there were no limits to his capacity for fasting? His public pretended to admire him so much. Why should it have so little patience with him? If he could endure fasting longer, why shouldn't the public endure it? Besides, he was tired. He was comfortable sitting in the straw. And now he was supposed to lift himself to his full height and go down to a meal, the very thought of which gave him a nausea that only the presence of the ladies kept him from betraying, and even that with an effort. And he looked up into the eyes of the ladies, who were apparently so friendly, and in reality so cruel, and shook his head, which felt too heavy on its strengthless neck. But then, there happened again what always happened. The impresario came forward without a word, for the band made speech impossible, lifted his arms in the air above the artist, as if inviting heaven to look down upon this creature here in the straw, this suffering martyr, which indeed he was, although in quite some other sense, grasped him around the emaciated waist with exaggerated caution, so that the frail condition he was in might be appreciated, and committed him to the care of the blenching ladies, not without secretly giving him a shaking, so that his legs and body tottered and swayed. The artist now submitted completely. His head lolled on his breast, as if it had landed there by chance. His body was hollowed out. His legs, in a spasm of self-preservation, clung close to each other at the knees, yet scraped on the ground, as if it were not really solid ground, as if they were only trying to find solid ground, and the whole weight of his body, a featherweight, after all, relapsed onto one of the ladies, who, looking around for help and panting a little — this post of honour was not at all what she had expected it to be — first stretched her neck as far as she could to keep her face at least free from contact with the artist, and then, finding this impossible, and her more fortunate companion not coming to her aid, but merely holding extended in her own trembling hand the little bunch of knuckle bones that was the artist's, to the great delight of the spectators, burst into tears and had to be replaced by an attendant who had long been stationed in readiness. Then came the food, a little of which the impresario managed to get between the artist's lips, while he sat in a kind of half-fainting trance, to the accompaniment of cheerful patter designed to distract the public's attention from the artist's condition. After that, a toast was drunk to the public, supposedly prompted by a whisper from the artist in the impresario's ear. The band confirmed it with a mighty flourish. The spectators melted away, and no one had any cause to be dissatisfied with the proceedings. No one except the hunger artist himself. He only, as always.
Fantastic, thank you.
To me, I feel that it's impossible to get away from the idea of the hunger artist as some kind of Christ figure. Existential Christ is not one that's bringing a message to humanity, but he's one who's trying to set aside all the hungers of the flesh as a preparation of his body and his soul and his spirit for death, probably. It's quite strange. He's actually conquering the hunger. This is why I like it being the hunger artist rather than the fasting artist, because I think that's what he's conquering. He's found a way of conquering his hunger. He's not doing a fast. A fast is what the impresario is selling. That's the commercial aspect of what's going on here. But I don't think it's a fast that the hunger artist is doing. The hunger artist is conquering his hunger. He's putting aside this human need for nourishment.
I mean, it's interesting that you pick up on this difference between hunger and fasting, because I was following your reading in I've got the Joachim Neugreschel, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but anyway, I've got the Neugreschel translation, and you've got the
Muir. That would be Muir.
So you've got the Muir translation.
We've got the Muir translation, indeed.
But interestingly, in the Neugreschel, which I bought after reading a lot of good things online by all sorts of Kafka cognoscenti, saying it's really good as a modern translation, he translates that line where the Muirs go in to start talking about fasting. He says he was quite prepared to spend a completely sleepless night with these watchmen, etc., etc. Anything to keep them awake, to continue showing them that there was nothing edible in the cage and that he hungered as none of them could hunger. So the Muirs say fast. He fasted like they couldn't fast. And I think it's really spot on going with your interpretation that Neugreschel has translated it as hunger, because it's almost like his hunger is not about not eating, but it's about doing this thing, this hunger, whatever this hunger is, it's a kind of desiring as well, isn't it? He's doing this very well.
This is his skill, yes, absolutely. Yes.
He hungers or desires better than we do.
Yes. And I think he if there's a weakness in his position, it is that he can't understand why other people don't. He doesn't see that as being a special thing that he's got. He sees it as part of humanity. And I think what confuses the hunger artist about how people relate to him is that they don't experience that. He experiences it, and he can't understand, he can't connect with people that don't experience with it. And that's what I think the story is about. It's about his isolation from the rest of humanity while being extremely human. Yes.
Is it perhaps that he has a sort of conscious acknowledgement and a conscious understanding of that hungering going on within him, whereas maybe the rest of humanity as he sees them, clearly they're hungering, because I mean we all hunger, don't we? We all hunger for something, as we know all too well. But possibly some people are not as aware of just how much they hunger. And this hunger artist is just acutely aware of the fact that he's hungry for something all the time.
Yes.
And there's a suffering there in that hunger.
Absolutely. And I think this is how that links back to the Christ and talking about Jesus as well. He's aware of that hunger, but for him that hunger is for God, and that people are looking for, they need the redemption that he's going to bring through his sacrifice to bring them to God. Now, the hunger artist hasn't got that. For him, it's just an emptiness. It's just all he's got to offer is a death. Really, he's not providing a salvation for people through that. But he is acutely aware of how it exists and how it affects him.
I wonder if part of the hunger, and also this is what makes it for me feel intensely modern, is if part of his hunger is about a hunger for control. I'm thinking particularly a thing that really struck me in the first few pages was that he's got nothing in his cage apart from this clock and this tiny little glass of water, and I just love that for that little line where it says you know, he would stare into space with almost closed eyes, so he's like he's meditating, and now and then taking a sip of water from a tiny glass in order to moisten his lips. And I just thought, I mean, there's something wonderful about that. So he's, I mean, you're saying that there's no depth to it, but there is something in my eyes quite wonderfully aspirational about this hunger artist, because he's in control. You know, he can just sit there with, he doesn't need any kind of external stimulation.
No.
Just occasionally just moisten his lips with this little sip of water.
I think the point you made about him being a consummate expert at what he's doing, I mean, and I think that's really true. Yes, he is. He is. He is a consummate expert. And I think that's one of the things that I think does get reflected.
Shall we continue reading?
Yes, okay. So, he lived for many years with small, regular intervals of recuperation. Invisible glory, honoured by the world. Yet in spite of that, troubled in spirit. And all the more troubled because no one would take his trouble seriously. What comfort could he possibly need? What more could he possibly wish for? And if some good-natured person, feeling sorry for him, tried to console him by pointing out that his melancholy was probably caused by fasting, it could happen, especially when he had been fasting for some time, that he reacted with an outburst of fury and, to the general alarm, began to shake the bars of his cage like a wild animal. Yet the impresario had a way of punishing these outbreaks, which he rather enjoyed putting into operation. He would apologise publicly for the artist's behaviour, which was only to be excused, he admitted, because of the irritability caused by fasting. a condition hardly to be understood by well-fed people. Then, by natural transition, he went on to mention the artist's equally incomprehensible boast that he could fast for much longer than he was doing. He praised his high ambition, the goodwill, the great self-denial undoubtedly implicit in such a statement, and then quite simply countered it by bringing out photographs, which were also on sale to the public, showing the artist on the 40th day of a fast, lying in bed, almost dead from exhaustion. This perversion of the truth, familiar to the artist though it was, always unnerved him afresh and proved too much for him. What was a consequence of the premature ending of his fast was here presented as a cause of it. To fight against this lack of understanding, against a whole world of non-understanding, was impossible. Time and again, in good faith, he stood by the bars, listening to the impresario. But, as soon as the photographs appeared, he always let go and sank with a groan back into his straw. And the reassured public could once more come close and gaze at him. A few years later, when the witnesses of such scenes called them to mind, they often failed to understand themselves at all. For meanwhile, the aforementioned change in public interest had set in. It seemed to happen almost overnight. There may have been profound causes for it, but who was going to bother about that? At any rate, the pampered hunger artist suddenly found himself deserted one fine day by the amusement seekers, who went streaming past him to other more favoured attractions. For the last time, the impresario hurried him over half Europe to discover whether the old interest might still survive here and there. All in vain. Everywhere, as if by secret agreement, a positive revulsion from professional fasting was in evidence. Of course, it could not really have sprung up so suddenly. And many premonitory symptoms, which had not been sufficiently remarked or suppressed during the rush and glitter of success, now came retrospectively to mind. But it was now too late to take any countermeasures. Fasting would surely come into fashion again at some future date. Yet that was no comfort for those living in the present. What then was the hunger artist to do? He had been applauded by thousands in his time and could hardly come down to showing himself in a street booth at village fairs. And, as for adopting another profession, he was not only too old for that, but too fanatically devoted to fasting. So, he took leave of the impresario, his partner in an unparalleled career, and hired himself to a large circus. In order to spare his own feelings, he avoided reading the conditions of his contract. A large circus, with its enormous traffic in replacing and recruiting men, animals and apparatus, can always find use for people at any time, even for a hunger artist, providing, of course, that he does not ask too much. And in this particular case, anyhow, it was not only the artist who was taken on, but his famous and long-known name as well. Indeed, considering the peculiar nature of his performance, which was not impaired by advancing age, it could not be objected that here was an artist past his prime, no longer at the height of his professional skill, seeking a refuge in some quiet corner of the circus. On the contrary, the hunger artist averred that he could fast as well as ever, which was entirely credible. He even alleged that if he were allowed to fast as he liked, and this was at once promised him without more ado, he could astound the world by establishing a record never yet achieved, a statement that certainly provoked a smile among the other professionals, since it left out of account the change in public opinion, which the hunger artist, in his zeal, conveniently forgot. He had not, however, actually lost his sense of the real situation, and took it as a matter of course that he and his cage should be stationed not in the middle of the ring as a main attraction, but outside, near the animal cages, on a site that was, after all, easily accessible. Large and gaily painted placards made a frame for the cage and announced what was to be seen inside it. When the public came thronging out in the intervals to see the animals, they could hardly avoid passing the hunger artist's cage and stopping there for a moment. Perhaps they might have even stayed longer had not those pressing behind them in the narrow gangway, who did not understand why they should be held up on their way towards the excitements of the menagerie, made it impossible for anyone to stand gazing for any length of time. And that was the reason why the hunger artist, who of course had been looking forward to these visiting hours as the main achievement of his life, began instead to shrink from them. At first, he could hardly wait for the intervals. It was exhilarating to watch the crowds come streaming his way. Until, only too soon, not even the most obstinate self-deception, clung to almost consciously, could hold out against the fact. The conviction was borne in upon him that these people, most of them, to judge from their actions again and again, without exception, were all on their way to the menagerie. And the first sight of them from a distance remained the best, for when they reached his cage, he was at once deafened by the storm of shouting and abuse that arose from the two contending factions, which renewed themselves continuously. Of those who wanted to stop and stare at him, he soon began to dislike them more than the others, not out of real interest, but only out of obstinate self-assertiveness, and those who wanted to go straight on to the animals. When the first great rush was past, the stragglers came along, and these, whom nothing could have prevented from stopping to look at him as long as they had breath, raced past with long strides, hardly even glancing at him in their haste to get to the menagerie in time. And all too rarely did it happen that he had a stroke of luck when some father of a family fetched up before him with his children, pointed a finger at the hunger artist, and explained at length what the phenomenon meant, telling stories of earlier years when he himself had watched similar but much more thrilling performances. And the children, still rather uncomprehending, since neither inside or outside school had they been sufficiently prepared for this lesson, what did they care about fasting, yet showed by the brightness of their intent eyes that new and better times might be coming. Perhaps, said the hunger artist to himself many a time, things would be a little better if his cage were not set not quite so near the menagerie. That made it too easy for people to make their choice, to say nothing of what he suffered from the stench of the menagerie, the animals' restlessness by night, the carrying past of raw lumps of flesh for the beasts of prey. The roaring at feeding times depressed him continually. But he did not dare to lodge a complaint with the management. After all, he had the animals to thank for the troops of people who passed his cage, among whom there might always be one here and there to take an interest in him. And who could tell where they might seclude him if he called attention to his existence, and thereby to the fact that, strictly speaking, he was only an impediment on the way to the menagerie. A small impediment, to be sure, one that grew steadily less. People grew familiar with the strange idea that they could be expected, in times like these, to take an interest in the hunger artist. And with this familiarity, the verdict went out against him. He might fast as much as he could, and he did so. But nothing could save him now. People passed him by. Just try to explain to anyone the art of fasting. Anyone who has no feeling for it cannot be made to understand it. The fine placards grew dirty and illegible. They were torn down. The little notice board showing the number of fast days achieved, which at first was changed carefully every day, had long stayed at the same figure. For after the first few weeks, even this small task seemed pointless to the staff. And so the artist simply fasted on and on, as he had once dreamed of doing. And it was no trouble to him, just as he had always foretold. But no one counted the days. No one. Not even the artist himself knew what records he was already breaking. And his heart became heavy. And when, once in a while, some leisurely passerby stopped, made merry over the old figure on the board, and spoke of swindling, that was, in its way, the stupidest lie ever invented by indifference and inborn malice. Since it was not the hunger artist who was cheating, he was working honestly, but the world was cheating him of his reward.
Thanks. So, is there anything in that section of the story that particularly draws your interest or your attention?
I don't believe the world is cheating him of his reward. That's quite a strange thing there. I'm not sure that that's what's going on.
Well, if his reward is that of being able to be in control, which in many ways is, you know, the sort of ultimate kind of existential fantasy, then the world is beginning to cheat him of this, because he is becoming less and less in control and more out of control. He's now just sort of, he's being overlooked. He's now just the impediment on the way to the menagerie, which is kind of, not to be gloomy, but that's the way we're all going, aren't we?
We're all
one day going to be the impediment on the way to the menagerie, whatever the menagerie is.
Yes. I think I would disagree with you. I think that, he is achieving and has got that freedom now. The fact that he's now not being harangued anymore as he used to be, and made to perform as he used to be by the impresario. Now he's at the circus, and now he's been forgotten. So he can carry on doing his fasting without anybody taking any notice of him whatsoever. And there's less and less. He's now totally focused on what he's doing.
But does he want that?
I think he does. My reading of it is that he does.
The first part, which we didn't talk about much, we didn't mention the ladies.
No.
He has this sort of curious relationship with the ladies, doesn't he? In the sense that they're sort of repulsed by him, but at least they're available to him to minister to him in a kind of nurse-like fashion. Mm. But he's getting attention. And is not in some way his hunger an attempt to get some of that attention, which he's now no longer getting? The ladies are out of the picture.
Well, they are indeed, but I see them perhaps as the dolly dealers that used to come along for Bruce Forsyth and and perform next to him. You know, it's just part of the show. It's part of the. I don't see that those ladies have got a relationship to the hunger artist himself. Their relationship is with the impresario.
So you don't think he's hungering in order to misguidedly attract those ladies?
No, I don't believe he is. No,
okay.
I believe he's working at the job that he loves, which is being a hunger artist.
Which is being hungry.
Which just happens
which is
to
being
be
despairing and desperate.
Yes, indeed. Which just happens to be something that can be made into a career that is made money out of. Yes, so that's a fortunate thing for him because he's got his board and keep, such as it is, while he's with the impresario and even while he's with the circus.
But if he's got what he wants to some extent, why is the second part, even more than the first part, the second part feels to me really quite sad and quite, you know, I get a sense of him becoming more and more bedraggled, more and more inward turning, depressed, mm-hmm. for want of a better word. This is not a man who's having his cake and eating it, or even having his cake. Which, of course, he wouldn't eat anyway.
Which he wouldn't eat anyway, no. Absolutely. And that's why I think it is a scary story. It's an existential story. This is what he's after. He's cutting himself off from everything. And
he's getting no pleasure from that.
No. Well, he's not looking for getting pleasure from it, surely. I think the...
But he's getting no satisfaction then.
Getting no satisfaction from it.
No meaning.
And I think the narrator here believes that he would want to get the satisfaction from it being publicly known that he was the world's greatest hunger artist.
And he's not even getting that.
And he's not getting that. I don't think he wants that. I don't think he needs that. I think the narrator here believes that he needs that. But I don't think he does. I think he's actually happiest now. And that clock's gone. And with the impresario, he's got the clock in the cage. At the zoo, no clock anymore. And they're not even keeping track of the days.
But is that not the root of what I would argue his desperation and his despair? Because it is only in some ways the clock, the fact that things are circumscribed, the fact that our discussion here is happening within a circumscribed space and a circumscribed time, that in some way makes it intensely meaningful and interesting and relevant. Whereas if you were just sitting at home having this conversation with yourself, I mean, you might be enjoying it as much,
yes.
But I certainly wouldn't.
No, that's true. And I think it's obviously a criticism that you would have of this fasting artist, that if those indeed were his aims, then what is he doing? What is the purpose of what he's doing? Because it doesn't relate to anybody else. It's a totally solipsistic thing that he's doing. It doesn't relate to other people.
Well, unlike the hunger artist, unfortunately, we do have a clock.
We do.
that clock is essentially the attention span of our... our listeners, who word has it, will only listen to a podcast for, you know, sort of 35 minutes. So maybe we'll read the last part.
Indeed, thank you. Many more days went by, however, and that too came to an end. An overseer's eye fell on the cage one day, and he asked the attendants why this perfectly good cage should be left standing there, unused, with dirty straw inside it. Nobody knew, until one man, helped out by the notice board, remembered about the hunger artist. They poked into the straw with sticks and found him in it. "Are you still fasting?" asked the overseer. "When on earth do you mean to stop?" "Forgive me, everybody," whispered the hunger artist. Only the overseer, who had his ear to the bars, understood him. "Of course," said the overseer, and tapped his forehead with a finger to let the attendants know what state the man was in. We forgive you. I always wanted you to admire my fasting, said the hunger artist. We do admire it, said the overseer affably. But you shouldn't admire it, said the hunger artist. Well then, we don't admire it, said the overseer. But why shouldn't we admire it?
Because I have to fast. I can't help it, said the hunger artist.
Oh, what a fellow you are, said the overseer. And why can't you help it?
Because,
said the hunger artist, lifting his head a little and speaking, with his lips pursed, as if for a kiss, right into the overseer's ear, so that no syllable might be lost.
Because I couldn't find the food I liked. If I had found it, believe me, I should have made no fuss and stuffed myself like you or anyone else.
These were his last words. But in his dimming eyes remained the firm, though no longer proud, persuasion that he was still continuing to fast. Well, clear this out now, said the overseer, and they buried the hunger artist, straw and all. Into the cage, they put a young panther. Even the most insensitive felt it refreshing to see this wild creature leaping around the cage that had long been so dreary. The panther was all right. The food he liked was brought to him without hesitation by the attendants. He seemed not even to miss his freedom, his noble body, furnished almost to the bursting point with all that it needed, seemed to carry freedom around with it too. Somewhere in his jaws it seemed to lurk, and the joy of life streamed with such ardent passion from his throat that for the onlookers it was not easy to stand the shock of it. But they braced themselves, crowded round the cage. I did not ever want to move away.
Thank you. That was a fantastic reading. Really amazing reading.
Thank you.
So that line, because I couldn't find the food I liked, if I had found it, believe me, I should have made no fuss and stuffed myself like you or anyone.
Hilarious, isn't it? I mean, we're all cracked up, you know. Oh, my gosh. It's only because he didn't ever have any pineapple and he really liked pineapple. He would have had it, you know.
I mean, is that the most tragic of lines?
Yes, I think it is. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, he's saying that I could have been like you and everything would have been, I wouldn't have been through all this. But I wasn't like you, so I have been through all this. Yeah.
It also feels to me so psychologically spot on in the sense that, you know, is not satisfaction, happiness, meaning, any of those words you want to sort of throw on to what makes a good life, essentially about hungering, as we all do, and finding in your own way the means to meet that hunger.
Hmm.
Knowing that you'll never meet all your hungers, but finding in some way, and this man has just never found the way to meet his hunger.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, it's there are longer things that you hunger after in life, and then there are the day-to-day things, you know, you've still got to stoke the fire, you've still got to do the washing, you've still got to do all those things in day-to-day life, and sometimes those are the things that get you through the bigger hungers that you've got for life. You ignore those other greater hungers, and I think
the hunger artist wasn't prepared to do that. He needed to really get to grips with those big hungers.
Yeah. And I mean, staying in touch with your hunger and working out what it is, I think, is important. But then equally, surely, you know, finding ways of, I mean, this is where we maybe come to our sort of interesting disagreement on this, yes? Mm. Because, you know, you sort of seem to be saying, well, that's enough to be really, really in touch with your hunger. And I'm sort of saying, well, you need to be in touch with your hunger, but then you need to also find ways of satisfying it.
Yes.
There's no point in just being sort of in touch with it.
No. Yeah. I think, yes, absolutely. That's where we have different views on the story. And, of course, that's one of the great powers of good stories, isn't it? That they bring out in you different viewpoints from different people, and it challenges you as to what you think about particular issues. And I think The Hunger Artist is a great story for doing that. It's one of the attractions of the story, yeah, that you need to decide for yourself. The story doesn't tell you what to think. You've got to decide for yourself, and that's always powerful writing. Does that? It provides you with information, hides some, makes some difficult to see, makes some easy to see, possibly misleads you a little bit here and there. You have to use your own experience and your own reading of the text to come up with your own reactions to it. And the richness of it is that we can get two different views on it just with two of us, and with six people here we'd probably have six different views.
That's right. And I also feel, you know, I mean, we've been talking for about an hour about this, but I feel we could, I could quite happily continue talking for a number of hours about this. There's still so much to say.
I think there's a lot to do with today, with our very commercial society, and you know, I think there's a lot in that story
even,
that talks about it.
We haven't even touched mentioned that. Eating disorders.
And
all of that, yes, that whole side of it, yeah, and you know, sort of models and anorexia and all of that, which of course I think a story like this is so, you know, key for as well.
Yes.
So, anyway,
absolutely,
you know, maybe another podcast.
Indeed, perhaps so.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.